Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Daniela Mestinek-Young, and she is the author of The Culting of America, What Makes a Cult and Why We Love Them. Now, Daniela is a cult survivor, a U.S. Army veteran, which are not mutually exclusive terms there, a Harvard-trained organizational psychologist, and the author of two books about high-control groups, Uncultured, her critically acclaimed memoir, and the one we're talking about today, The Culting of America. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Daniela.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's just get out of the way your background as a cult survivor, because obviously that has influenced your work and your
Oh,
life's
for
work
sure.
a lot. Yeah. So.
Yeah, so I was born 3 generations into the Children of God. The Children of God is one of these big famous cults from the 60s. They were known for religious prostitution and pedophilia in their beliefs. Produced Joaquin and River Phoenix and Rose McGowan. We were the entertainment cult. And so my grandfather joined this cult in the 70s and very quickly became one of their finance people. My mother was one of the first children born in and would then be pregnant at the age of 14 by the other finance guy, his boss, in fact, which does make my father older than my grandfather.
Wow.
Sex cult math.
Yeah.
And then I was raised in the Children of God until I sort of engineered my own excommunication at the age of 15, at which point I was summarily dropped off in Texas with an older stepsister and sort of dropped into high school, into the world, and had a very shocking kind of experience with that. I'll leave it there for questions.
Wow, and to learn more, you can read Uncultured. But what I'm curious about is how you even were able to break free at the age of 15. Now, I do realize that that is an age where young people often do rebel against whatever their parents have forced down their throats. But still, you were in such an all-immersive environment. How did you even know that there was anything that you could go to?
So one of the things we have found now that we have enough survivors who were born into cults, cult babies, we call ourselves, is that programming and brainwashing doesn't necessarily work well on children. And I think there's a big thing there, which is that we buy into our own indoctrination. And I just wasn't having it. Like, I believe that I was just a neurodivergent atheist born to religious extremists. By the age of 6, I was experiencing the worst kinds of abuse. It's in the memoir. And by the age of 6, I remember very specifically being like, if this is God and this is love, like, I don't want anything to do with it. I will be out of here as soon as I can. Which for me meant 18 because my grandparents were also in the cult. My whole family was in the cult. That being said, at around the age of 14, when I was, cults are organized crime. Like I was being heavily trafficked through Mexico and lower Texas as a performer, carnival clown, kitchen slave, all of these things. And I just had had enough. I started rebelling. There's also the very important fact that in the Children of God, even after they supposedly reformed and became the family, it was still a group of free love, forced polyamory, and you were considered an adult at the age of 16, and there was no birth control. So one of the realities for me growing up with a mother who had become a mother at the age of 15 was like, I actually need to get out of here before I'm 16, not before I'm 18.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I ended up, as I said, my mom was married off to someone who was 20 years older than her, and he had children. And one of those, you know, grown children who had left the cult allowed me to come and like live with her. So I had a place to land. She also didn't know anything about the world, having left only a few years before, you know, so it's not like I had a tremendous amount of guidance or mentorship. And in fact, I got very lucky that a counselor, there were four counselors and 4,000 students. And this counselor saw me, helped me, put me on the path to college, which really changed a lot of things for me. But yeah, it was scary. You know, at 15, I essentially was given the choice to like double down on this cult or be thrown into like lose everything that you know, and just be tossed out into the world.
How were you supposed to support yourself financially?
I mean, they didn't really care about that.
Well,
I literally got dropped off with $0, and which was actually kind of challenging because most places in the U.S. don't want to hire you until you're 16. I ended up being able to get a job at Chick-fil-A, which is its own culty thing. and, you know, I just worked, and college was even harder, but you know, this is where sometimes things work out. Like I made a lot of money in college making balloon animals at kids' birthday parties, a skill that I had from being trafficked as a carnival clown.
Oh, wow. Okay. So then joining the army, what drove you to do that? What motivated that?
Okay, so definitely a bad marriage. Like that was the first big thing. I fell into, in college, unsurprisingly, the kind of relationship that we sometimes call a 1-1 cult. And, you know, outside of cult studies, we usually call that an abusive relationship. A decade after I divorced him, the army would contact me to testify against him to be thrown out of the army for violent white supremacist beliefs on the internet, etc. So like he was in the beginning stages of becoming a very bad guy. Mm. And I married him. And then I realized I didn't want to be stuck being an army wife, trailing, you know, like he wanted to be a politician. And I sort of had this like, I fought hard to get my life. What am I doing? So I decided I'd join the army too. And, you know, it was also interesting looking back because, you know, if I hadn't had joined the army, I would have had a PhD by the age of 25. That's the track I was on. The outside world was just terrifying. You know, I don't think I would have known how to go out into the world with a degree in English and kind of do anything with that, right? Like I was so used to being in high control situations. And even in college, when I look back, you know, I was working between 1 and 4 jobs. I graduated valedictorian. I'd never been in school before. Like I put myself into kind of a high control environment. And one of the defining features is you never have time to think. And I think that was me trying to help myself survive. You know, like if I had had time to think about all of my trauma, I would have just completely broken, I think, at the age of 18 or 20. And that would happen later. But fortunately, I got through education and like the beginning of a career before all my trauma caught up with me. And that helped me out.
So I'm assuming at some point you realized that studying cult psychology was what you needed to do. And so when, like where in your journey did that happen? And
so I will say first that, you know, in my book Uncultured, it starts off on the first day of basic training and we are being yelled at and we have to hold these 50-pound duffel bags over our heads. And day one, I was like, oh, this is another cult. Like, I just joined another cult. Honestly, my second thought was, well, I'm going to be better at it than the rest of these suckers, right? Because I know how to do this. I know how to tamp down my individuality and just perform. So I didn't see it as a bad thing at the time. I was just like, okay, this is what I'm doing now. Okay. And I very much also had the idea that, like, I'm trading 3 years of my life for benefits and the future and all that.
Right. Right.
That being said, I became an intelligence officer. The intelligence officer is the one that is the expert on the enemy. And because we were in the war on terror, I was heavily trained on and then experienced in studying terrorist organizations.
Okay.
So fast forward all the way to 2020, when I went back to school and I got a master's in organizational psychology at Harvard. And I thought I was going to do leadership consulting, which is what almost everybody does with that degree. However, because all of my experience in group behavior in this executive program was talking about cults or the military or terrorist groups, I started to realize two things. One, that I was already an expert on bad guys and maybe I should follow that path. But two, that everyone else in my program just assumed that they were going to work for the good guys. And that was very interesting to me because we were all studying cult tactics. Like, that's what organizational psychology is. Like, you're studying how to motivate groups of people. And cults just use those things to the extreme. And so I realized that people didn't think of cults as successful organizations, right? Like, cults, terrorist group, anything we call bad, we don't think of it as successful. And anything we that is successful financially, we think of as good. And I said, I think it's much, much more complicated than that.
Yes, yes.
And I also just decided, like, I like being an expert on bad guys and bad groups. And I think there is usefulness in that. But one of the things I decided then was that I didn't really care about the groups. I cared about helping individuals navigate groups. And so I turned my focus. I got big on social media and I wrote Culting of America, which is kind of my, it's not a call out book about cults. It is a cult tactics book. It is, these are 10 parts of group behavior that cults use to manipulate you. And I'm going to show those to you in real cults in the United States military and then in all kinds of organizations around us that you probably haven't thought of.
Right.
Of course, in the last year of writing the book, this very significant cult got the government, and things have been very interesting since then.
Yeah, I've been thinking your next book might be How to Get Out of the MAGA Cult. But
I'm writing a future book called An All-American Fascism right now.
And okay,
I do think that there will be a book on MAGA in the future, but also, I'm looking to mentor a book by someone who grew up in MAGA, because when I was dropped into Texas in 2003, it was very obvious to me that a bunch of American millennials had also grown up in cult experiences. It just didn't have a name. And that, all of those individual cults that started in the 30s, really got started in the 60s, started organizing under Reagan in the 80s, that all became MAGA. So there is millions, I believe, of children who grew up in what was becoming MAGA, being these soldiers in God's end time army working for this Christian theocracy, which is what they want. And yes. It's also the reason they've been so successful, because cults know how to coordinate and make operations plans and then march their people toward an outcome.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm flashing back to an interview that I did probably at least 15 years ago with Marcos Melitzas, he was the founder of Daily Cause. KOS. And he wrote a book called American Taliban. about that. It's
Yeah.
It was the American Taliban, how war, sex, sin, and power bind jihadists and the radical right.
Sounds like I need to read that for my next book.
And talk to him. So, another person, do you know Liz Lenz? She wrote This
Yes.
American Wife, I think. And she was raised, homeschool, fundamentalist, right wing in Texas, and is now very much a progressive, a voice for progressiveness, and has a very successful newsletter called Men Yell at Me.
Nice.
And she's here in
Yep.
Iowa, which is where I am. She's in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So, when I started reading, The Culting of America, it's like cults are ev or cultish behavior is everywhere, obviously. And so one of the things that this book does is let you see the groups that you're in, how you're not really saying, well, for example, you talk about AA a lot and the cultish behavior in AA, but you're not saying AA is a cult, but that it can lead to sort of some, it can have some of the effects of a cult.
And so I've decided that I'm a different kind of expert because I can be, because I came from a cult that everybody agrees is a cult, right? So instead of spending my time defining cults and then saying which exact groups are cults, because that's always going to change. And also, we're never going to know all of them because you have one-one cults, you have single-family cults, right? They're just coming up all of the time. So I wanted to focus more on like the behavior. And this is the part that people don't like. So one of my favorite examples is language. So one of, in everybody's definition of cult, it's my number six, is a distinguishable vernacular, right? Cults have their own language. This works because it makes you feel special. It makes you more isolated from outsiders. We can think about how difficult it is to listen to a veteran talk about the military, right? A big part of what I did in Uncultured is translate my military experience into civilian language. I don't use one acronym or like one military term without telling you what it means. So, and also you get loaded language, right? Stuff that means something to the group that doesn't mean to outside. You get thought-stopping cliches, terms to shut down doubts. All of these things come from having your own language. So people want, they say, what about lines of business that just have their own professional jargon, like engineering, like medical, like the military? And they want me to say, oh, that's fine. That's not a cult, right? But the answer is, yeah, you're just more at risk. That distinguishable vernacular works the same way in a regular group, as it works in a cult. It makes you feel more special. We've all met doctors, right? It isolates you from the outside and it does all of those things. You just have to be more careful. And so, this is what I say about my book. Like, I wrote it as a tool, and it's not for you to be like, everything I am is a cult. Like, you, in my opinion, you got to have all 10 of these things to be a cult, and they all hook into each other.
Well, really, you do.
However, if you have three to five of them and you're looking to make your group less toxic, start with those. Like you don't, and so I say at the end of the day, I don't care what we call a group. Alcoholics Anonymous, like telling people that they're going to die if they're not in your program, that's a cult tactic, right? So, like, why are we using it? Even if ultimately, and it's very interesting with Alcoholics Anonymous because cults are phenomenal at getting people sober. The Children of God got 10,000 people sober. Scientology gets people sober because it's relatively easy to give up your vice and then just addict
Something
onto the
else.
group. The US military gets us all sober when they deploy us for a year, and that is a huge drinking environment. So it is, I am trying to challenge Alcoholics Anonymous, like, why are you the sacred moose? Why do you think that just because you do good, you cannot be a harmful organization or that you are above evaluation. And this is really important to me because I know that the military is not going to go away. I know that Alcoholics Anonymous is not going to go away. And I want, you know, I think I was safer in the military because I realized it was a cult and I realized like this was the game that I needed to play. And I just want people to have that information up front because we are all in all of our groups are problematic, right? All of our systems are problematic.
I know,
because
so,
they were
so
all built.
So as I'm reading this and you know, I am a company founder and my business employs hundreds of people around the world. And it's a manufacturing, it's a consumer product design and manufacturing company. And it's like some of the things that I've tried to implement in the business that I thought, you know, were to help employees. I read this, I'm like, oh my God. Maybe even though my intentions were good, it isn't always good.
So I think there's a reason for that, which is that organizational psychology, cults, the military, like all of these hooked into each other. Like the military discovered brainwashing in the 60s and started using it on troops. Organizational psychology was just becoming a thing at that time. They studied the military. And then, you know, one of the things that I write about later in the book, or no, I think it's actually in the first chapter, is like, we actually lived through an apocalypse, which was the technology age, right? The information age, the industrial age running into the information age. And out of this apocalypse rose the tech bro founder, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things I realized studying organizational psychology is like, these dudes are cult leaders. In fact, often they're intentionally copying cult leaders, trying to make this military bonding or this cult bonding. And a lot of these tactics are cult leader tactics. Yeah. But the important thing here is that tools are tools. You know, so most of these things are not bad, except exploitation of labor. There's two things on my cult list: constant self-sacrifice of members and exploitation of labor, which I don't think can be positive. But
right.
Everything else, it's how you use it. And this is even why I made up my own word in chapter 3 for the weaponization of the mission. I call it missionizing. You know, it's a great tool to have a mission that people care about. My company has a mission that people care about and want to work toward. But I do not weaponize that mission in order to get unhealthy levels of work and dedication out of them. And that's what the cult leaders do. And that's what a lot of nonprofits do, you know,
yeah,
and they mean
yeah.
well, but they are still harming the individual. And that's really like my scholarship. It's like, I don't care what you intend. I care what the outcome is of the thing that you did on the people in that group.
Right, right. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Daniela Mestinek Young, author of The Culting of America. One thing I've always, when I think about cults, I've always thought about how blurry the line is between any religious group and a cult. And is there a point, like, I feel like most religious groups today probably were considered cults at one time, or at least by some people would have been considered cults or heretics or something like that, and then somehow they become mainstream. How does that happen, and what is the dividing line?
So, you know, first of all, we got to understand that the word cult only really became pejorative in the 70s after Jonestown, followed by Manson. And then we started saying, okay, cults are these things. And okay. And again, we only really discovered brainwashing and thought reform in the 60s. So what I feel like happened is people started studying cults, but everything that came before was grandfathered out, right? So like every cult scholar that I know says that the Mormon Church and the Jehovah's Witnesses are cults. But we didn't really start talking about that until like the 2000s. We, you know, Mormons was actually an example of how something can start as a cult, go through this process called routinization, which is basically becoming more and more bureaucratic. And then, poof, it's not a cult anymore. And we just know that that's not how it works anymore. Yeah. So that is one thing. And then there's the religious question. So first of all, I always explain that like a religion is an identity, right? That is a worldview, right? Christianity is a worldview. Being a Christian is an identity. I also talk about Swiftianity as a worldview, and being a Swifty is an identity that I held for 20 years.
But not anymore, that, or still?
No, I'm deconstructing it. I'm using my own work, my own workbook that comes along with Culting of America to deconstruct Swiftianity.
Okay.
But so one of the things is that because the big main cults that blew up were religious, we conflate religious groups and cults, right? And a cult doesn't give you a religion. They give you a worldview. It can be anything. You can write a science fiction novel and make that your worldview. We call that Scientology, which had an outsized effect. Scientology has had a huge effect on American culture, corporate culture, self-help culture, all of this stuff. So it's not the religion. I always say, like, it's not the Ianity or the ism that is ever a problem, right? Right. So I do think that many, many, many churches and religious groups in America have devolved to cult status because of the culting of America, because of the extremism journey that we've been on. There was also this thing called the Cult Wars, which was in the 80s. Americans were asking for laws about coercive control and trying to deal with what had come out of the 70s. And religious leaders were like, you know what? No. So they went to religious scholars, and there was this whole movement, the term new religious movement, the whole idea that you shouldn't call things cults, and also that you shouldn't listen to cult survivors. Like all of this was born and has had another big effect on, you know, what is a cult and what is a religion. And this is another reason why I don't, you know, like I don't spend any time arguing that IHOP, you know, International House of Prayer is a cult. I just tell my cult stories and talk in detail about how this very extreme cult worked. And if you're relating to the stories of me growing up in a very extreme cult, maybe you want to think about that more.
Right,
you know?
Right. So what are your 10 kind of cult requirements?
Okay, so the first is charismatic authority. And it's important to know that that can be an idea or a person.
Okay, because sometimes it starts out as a person, but the person dies, the idea continues.
And it transfers to a cult of idea. I believe that's what happened with Mormonism versus Scientology, which was always kind of a cult of an idea. L. Ron Hubbard cared more about the world that he built than he cared about himself being deified. In reverse, Donald Trump showed up and took all of these cults of idea. I call that idea racist conservatism. And he pulled them into his cult of personality, MAGA. Cults of personalities rarely pass down. So that's like the good thing here. This is what the founder of the Children of God did, was he showed up in a cult era and he pulled a bunch of other cults into his group. Anyways, okay. So the first one can be a leader or an idea. And also charismatic authority doesn't mean charming. It means you've chosen to give them authority over you. That's all it means. So number two is the sacred assumption. This one I invented, and it is the one thing you must believe to be a member in good standing of that group. In the Children of God, it was that this man is the prophet of God. In the United States Army, it's that the American flag is worth dying for. You know, if you don't believe those things, you're not going to be very successful in this high control group. Usually the sacred assumption is some version of we are the one, the only. This is why cults love the word the. Okay, number three is the transcendent mission. It is a mission that is so good and so big, and it justifies all the sacrifice that they're going to require of you. It's usually promised after some version of space travel. Cults always promise space travel is something that I say. And the reason people join cults is because of the mission, right? Nobody's trying to dedicate themselves to a person. They're joining for this mission. Number four is self-sacrifice, constant self-sacrifice. That is how they break you. They are trying to break you from your personality and make you become this pseudo personality, kind of like a little meat puppet walking around that they can just get labor out of. And self-sacrifice is how they do that. Number five is isolation. Isolation is crucial to fanatic beliefs, but isolation has changed. It no longer means you're off on a commune in Texas or Brazil. You can be in a cult, in your bedroom, on the internet. We also have algorithmic radicalization now. Yeah. The tech overlords decided that feeding us more extreme content keeps us on longer. So we have isolation and radicalization going on through technology. Number six, distinguishable vernacular, we talked about. That is the longest chapter though, because it's so important. Mm-hmm. Number seven, us versus them mentality. And in this chapter, we talk about how cults have that, but also just America, like the whole history of America and how sort of culty we have been since the beginning. But it's very important that a cult is not just for something, they're also against something. Wow. So the us versus them. Number eight is exploitation of labor. This is, people get stuck at the what cults did, like pedophilia with Children of God, and they don't get to why. Why the Children of God existed was we were an army of 7,000 singing, dancing children around the world, begging on streets, making money for the cult, millions and millions of dollars. Number nine is high exit costs, which everyone talks about. I have added high entrance costs to that. You pay a lot to go into these groups, and not just money, cutting off friends and family, right? Like all different kinds of entrance costs. And then exit costs are everything you lose when you leave the group, which is usually a lot more than money. Mm-hmm. And finally, number 10, ends justifies the means mentality. And this is where, I mean, we see it all around us right now, but in pursuit of purity, in pursuit of that transcendent mission, they will justify anything. Children of God justified literal pedophilia because they believed this man was saving us before the end of the world.
Yeah, well, that's not too different from things going on today, is it?
Correct. Correct.
Anyone say Epstein files? No.
And also, the Children of God performed twice at the White House in the 90s. So I have known that the connection between like pedophilia and the government, or I have suspected, I should say, runs much deeper.
Wow.
In the way that we are all finding out now.
Wow. Okay. So when you decided to write this book, did you already have those 10 points well developed, or did that come about in the process of writing?
I was developing them. So what happened is I got on social media and people said, what's your definition of cult? And I hate definitions of cults because they're never all inclusive. They're never quite everything. So I resisted it, but then I was like, well, I'm going to have to come up with a definition. And instead of using someone else's definition, I would rather come up with my own definition since I'm on the internet explaining it every day. So I did a organizational psychology definition, which is something we haven't had before, focusing on the group behavior parts of it. And it was while I was doing that that I actually realized that, yes, the Army fits every part of this definition, especially on a deployment or something like that. But the idea for the book definitely came to me just all in one day. Same thing with Uncultured. It's like something is going around in my head for a long time, and then I just sit down and write an outline. Wow. So I thought it was going to be a quick book to write. It ended up taking 3 years.
Okay. All right. And it's structured basically with the 10 chapters of those 10 points, and then an 11th chapter called Just Groups. What is that one?
So that chapter was born out of my frustration with the fact that I am very clear that I study bad guys and bad groups. And then people go, well, what about good groups? You know, they just want like an easy answer. And I was like, so two things, you know, I wrote a chapter that is just groups, which is groups are groups, right? It's how you use it. All groups are on this spectrum somewhere. But I also spent a lot of time thinking about how we ask the wrong people the answers. You know, the expert on bad groups is not the person that's going to be the one to advise you on how to build a good group. This is, at least that's the way I think it should work. At least, you know, one of the things I liked about the military is my job was to be the expert on the bad guys. And it didn't matter what the commander wanted to do. It was just my job to tell you all the bad stuff. And then you have to go figure out the good stuff. And another thing is that I have been working on deconstructing whiteness and white supremacy, which is, I think, a whole cult system that we have over everything. And I was just very aware of the fact that people with my skin tone historically aren't the ones building good groups. So I asked a Black woman who mentors me, and we have a podcast about white supremacy, to contribute a chapter. And she wrote, I mean, what's been called one of the best essays in the book for sure. She gives us this really beautiful chapter or essay on community versus groups. Mm-hmm. And I do kind of think one of the reasons that America is so culty, especially white America, is because we have destroyed real community. Or maybe never had it here in the first place. And so we go into one group after the other group looking for, you know, the thing I say what cults do right, which is mission and purpose and community. But we don't understand that we're getting like broken versions of it. And so the last chapter is to really tell you why this matters, what you can do with all of these bad tactics, and also to help people begin to think that it's not just about finding good groups. It is a whole new paradigm that we need to be working toward.
Well, and you do get into this a little bit. You know, part of the whole America was built on this this idea of individualism as being primary over the common good. But the individual good is more important than the common good. And we celebrate independence, individualism, the kind of separating yourself. And yet, that almost leads to more susceptibility to cults. It's like, though they seem to be opposites.
Absolutely. Well, it absolutely is. And I think that's because one of the reasons is that individualism is a lie. you know, like none of us do anything on our own, right? Like no man is an island.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
People love to use me as an example of a self-made person. And I'm still like, no, I had, you know, so much help along the way. Plus we have systems and structures here that are helpful, but like individualism is lonely and awful. And it speaks to no part of our actual humanity, you know, and this is where I think that America really lost its way when it comes to community. And the other thing is work. You know, I'm reading, yes, a lot of history books now for the next piece I'm working on. And there is this, you know, Englishman lamenting in the 1800s that when you go to America, there's no interesting men to hang out with during the day and just have discussions in bars because they're all working.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
So this, good essay we have in the book, contributed by an American historian, is about the Puritans and the Puritan work ethic and how much that has filtered down into America. And those two things, individualism and work all the time, you know.
That's a very good point, because in most of history, most other countries, success meant not having to work, right? If you know, and wealthy families raised their kids to not work. I mean, the idea of being a, you know, going out and starting a business, being a merchant, if you were from a royal family or, you know, a noble family, no, you just didn't do that. And now but on the other hand, I feel like people who don't have structured work in their lives are rarely happy.
And that is because I think of the rest of the culture and of how we look at those things, you know. So my husband and I have both played the role of primary parent, you know, the person who's not earning, who's doing all the other stuff. And we, early in our marriage, we agreed, like, we are equal humans. It doesn't matter who's making more money or who's working or not working. But we both realized that, like, when you're doing the unpaid, unrecognized labor, like, it doesn't feel good. You know, but our country was made to be that way. You know, when we decided to calculate GDP, and leave out unpaid labor, that was a choice, you know, about what motivates,
what counts,
things.
Yeah.
It's one of the interesting things. So, you know, first of all, the chapter on labor is called Nobody Wants to Work Hard Anymore. And one of the things I say is I think that millennials and younger are buying out of the sacred assumption of you just work for the man. Also, an interesting experience in my own life is I got to live on passive income from the military, et cetera. And I didn't just lay around and do nothing. I built a whole career. I wrote 2 books, you know, so we hear this idea, oh, the robots are just going to take over and everyone's going to get a stipend. And I don't think that sounds horrible. I think we will make more art and music and community. You know, I don't think robots taking all the jobs is good, but I think having universal basic income and services where people don't have to work just to survive.
Maybe
would end up in,
but the problem is
creative, interesting things.
Yeah, except there's always going to be things that the robots can't do that aren't fun and aren't easy. And who's going to want to do that? Who are you going to get to do that if nobody has to work?
So this is where I think like the gig economy could be very interesting, but only if we change our culture. Because I think people would do almost any job if they had dignity and were well taken care of. You know, I think somebody would buy a garbage truck and have that be what they do, go around and pick up the garbage if they were treated well. You know, I think about like, I would pay someone to go grocery shopping for me so I never had to do it again, you know, or to like gas up my car. You know, some enterprising young person could buy a gas truck and just go around corporations.
But why would they if they didn't need to make money?
Oh, because people don't like to be bored.
Yeah. But it's, I sometimes feel like people don't want to be bored, but most people would rather do fun things if they had could do whatever they wanted. And so I've always been a little bit resentful of people with a certain degree of talent, musical, artistic, whatever, who feel like they shouldn't have to get a regular job because they have this talent and they should just get paid for doing this. And it's like, well, everybody would like to do that, but we all have to work. And so what makes, why should you be different?
Agreed. Agreed. I mean, I love the fact that I love what I do.
And I wish everybody did. It's just that I think there's going to be some task that nobody truly loves to do. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are people out there who actually really love cleaning bathrooms. But
I think that we would figure it out as a society. Like, we would figure out a way to prioritize the things that must be done, or like the dirty jobs.
Yeah.
In a way that would work. But it's not going to work if it's just like earning is the number one thing we care about, which it has been.
Oh, it always, you know? Yes, absolutely. Daniela, we're almost out of time and I haven't had you read yet. So could you please read from The Culting of America?
All right. I'm going to read the prologue, but I'm going to tell everybody else to go read the space travel part because it's very cool. All right. Prologue. You're probably in a cult. You just don't know it yet. Don't believe me? See if you recognize one of the world's most notorious and widespread sex cults, with members spanning the entire socioeconomic spectrum. Followers flocked to a charismatic leader. He radically changed American culture and maybe even the world. He was edgy, rebellious, and said exactly what the youth of America were thinking at the time. His revelations were sexual and pushed the boundaries of American culture. Men worshipped him with their money, women with their bodies. Survivors of his cult, a few of them teenagers when they joined, initially arrived with bright eyes and visions of grandeur. Little by little, they began to feel trapped, caught in a world they hadn't signed up for, filled with high commune walls, isolation, and constant surveillance. These young women were often paraded in public, luring in the money and bodies of others with their sexuality. They had fallen down the proverbial rabbit hole into a world where none of the normal rules applied. To the outside observer, they lived glamorously, while internally they sublimated themselves in order to play their parts, allowing their emotions to be deadened and suppressed, and their bodies and labor to be exploited. Even years after their leader's death, the cult rakes in millions from followers of the Playboy brand. How did so many come to believe that Hugh Hefner was changing the world for the better? This description wasn't Jim Jones, the Branch Davidians, NXIVM, or the Children of God. The Playboy organization, more or less accepted by mainstream society, isn't the faraway, sinister, and strange world we think of when we hear the word cult. How could an organization so well known actually be something a cult scholar like me could compare to a sex cult? I was born and raised in the Children of God, a sex cult known as one of the most notorious religious sects in the world. It's what most people would call a real cult. As a survivor, a scholar, and someone who has already written one book about life behind the walls of a cult, I find a stunning number of parallels between the life I survived and what is woven through the reports of the survivors of life at the Playboy Mansion. After surviving 15 years in isolation under religious extremists, I escaped to America and threw myself into education. I became an intelligence officer in the US Army, another kind of total institution. Later, I studied terrorists for my job, then earned my master's in organizational psychology at Harvard during the pandemic, just as the world slipped into its own strange cult-like isolation. Across all these worlds, I saw the same patterns repeat: the pull toward group control, the high cost of leaving, and the sacred assumptions that keep members tethered. Watching the pandemic unfold, I was fascinated, but not surprised, to see isolation do what it always does: push us into increasingly polarized mindsets, so disconnected from our fellow Americans that it sometimes feels like we no longer share the same reality. In The Culting of America, I explore 10 core aspects of group dynamics that I have developed to define what makes a cult. I talk about how the dynamics are used in cults and extreme groups to achieve coercive control, but also how they show up in socially accepted cults, like the US Army, where we find that same behavior in groups we don't call cults, the groups we are all in. Through meticulous research and interviews with sociologists, psychologists, cult experts, and survivors, I make the case that if we look at our regular groups for signs of cultiness, we have to acknowledge that harmful group behavior exists on a spectrum, not a binary, and it is present in even some of our best good groups. The truth is, many of the dynamics that scholars have used to rely on as markers of extreme groups have become strikingly common as primary features of many of America's mainstream groups today. I see cult-like behavior everywhere, in so many groups, and it's been increasing in intensity at a frightening pace. When I put it all together, everything I've studied, everything I've experienced as a cult survivor, I can't help but feel that we are living through the culting of America. And my guess is that you feel it on some level too. I've spent my life attempting to understand cults, which I've learned is inseparable from understanding human nature, human needs, group psychology, and culture. Braided through the stories of my life are truths I've come to know: that human beings will do almost anything to be accepted by a group, that we all search for belonging and purpose more than anything else in life, and that, at the end of the day, extremism is harder to recognize than any of us think. As humans, we are programmed to look for connection, community, purpose, and an ideology to adhere to. These things give meaning to our lives. You are undoubtedly a member of many groups: families, companies, clubs, churches, political affiliations, communities, nations. You probably also have things you believe in with all your heart, ideas you will defend with passion against anyone who challenges them. But what if the very things that make you feel safest are also the ones trapping you the most? When does conviction turn into an us versus them mentality? When does loyalty turn into loss of autonomy? This book will attempt to answer these questions and more, and ultimately leave you with the biggest question of all: what cults am I in?
Thank you. And that's Daniela Mestinek Young reading from The Culting of America, the prologue. And where is the section on space travel?
It's in chapter 3 in the mission. It's called Missionizing in Space, and it starts with the Space Force.
Yes. Yeah. So you have a co-author.
Yes.
For this book. How did you work, you know, what was her role and how did the two of you work together?
So we started working together with Uncultured. She is one of the two co-authors of Uncultured. That is how you get really good writing sometimes. We did this book. I do most of my books with co-writers, and Amy played a really important role in this book because she has the much more normal life And so the way it really works is I see the extremism in everything, and then she's able to help it be not so extreme, or for the book to be not so binary. If it were up to me, I would have called Alcoholics Anonymous a cult. She tempers it a little bit. So, and also, we both love research. So 38-page bibliography, 400 endnotes. It was definitely a group thing to do together. And Amy Reed is actually a very successful author of young adult novels and writes a lot about youth and trauma, which is how we got connected in the first place, because that's what I needed to write about. And, you know, another cool thing about this book, another co-author of this book was the general public, because I crowdsourced this book. I was on the internet. I'm on the internet every day as Knitting Cult Lady. And as I would write about a new thing, I would read it to my audience, who would then give me feedback, give me their examples. Most of the individuals, cult survivors that I quote in here, are people that I met online. And so it was really kind of a joint effort to help write this really useful book.
Well, you know, one thing I was curious about, do you have any contact with your birth family?
I do.
Are they still in the cult?
They left the cult. My mother, at 38 with 7 children, was able to get everybody out after, of course, her being born and raised in the cult. And my mother has been through an amazing journey of deconstruction, and she and I are very close. We do lives on TikTok sometimes where she has a channel about grief. But, you know, family relations after cults tend to be very complicated because you don't know how to be a family. They destroy the family. So my relationship with my family, like every other cult survivor, is complicated. But I do have a very, very strong relationship with my mom, which I am very grateful about.
I just can't imagine what it must have been to be, give birth at 15 in that environment and have no say over your life really at all. And wow. Hats off to your mom.
When I was born, she was so excited that she could give me a name and cut my hair whenever she wanted, because she was not even allowed to cut her own hair or choose like anything for her own life.
Wow.
Which just really emphasizes how much control it was.
Yeah. Well, there is so much more we could talk about. I mean, we could go on like this for hours, because this is a really important subject, especially today. So thank you so much for being with us, Daniela. And we always close with a quote. And the one that I picked is not entirely true, but it is, I think, partially true. And it's from Tom Wolfe. A cult is a religion with no political power.
We had actually written, cults are always out for political power, and in today's America, they seem to be getting it. And then we had to change that too. And in today's America, they have gotten it. Fascist nations, totalitarian nations are a type of cult. They can be small groups with little importance. They can also be North Korea.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much for having me.